Hello and welcome to this episode of Palate Exposure, the podcast. Each week, Alona Thompson sits down with guests from wine to cooking to travel to share their stories. This week, she sat down with Dario Satui. A San Francisco native, his earliest mentor was his great-grandfather who founded a winery in San Francisco in 1885. As a kid, Dario ran and played amongst the barrels, dreaming of his own winery one day. His dream came to reality in 1975 when he opened a consumer-focused winery in St. Helena. A passionate businessman and an avid philanthropist, Dario supports a variety of causes from music to land and conservation to children and animals causes. This week, before I could even get the equipment set up, the two were already talking. So as you listen, realize you're jumping into a conversation that is already speeding away. Enjoy.
And the hotels would overcrowd, they charge too much, they give you almost nothing.
Yep.
And I thought, damn it, you know, I have this facility, we'll do something, and we'll do something great.
Yes.
And make people happy and give them their money's worth. And we did. We started, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, I don't remember. And about 4 years ago, Travel and Leisure magazine was here at New Year's. I didn't know they were here.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote that we were one of the top 17 venues in the world to go to on New Year's Eve, which was, I had to read it in the magazine because they didn't even tell me that.
That gave
me a lot of satisfaction. You know, I like making money, you know, I won't deny it. But if I can make people happy and make them want to come back and make a dollar, basically I've done it all. And spread the word to other potential consumers, I feel real good. Are you recording these things or should I save some of them?
He's looking sheepish, I think so.
You can splice it in if you like it.
Yes.
See, you can believe me or not believe me, I didn't restart my great-grandfather's winery with the idea I was going to get rich. I restarted it because I wanted to bring back the family winery that was forced out of business in 1921 with the advent of Prohibition. And that, you know, again, making money is just a little gravy. But that wasn't the reason I started. I was passionate. Ever since I was a little kid, 10, 12 years old, I wrote to the Wine Institute to try to get some information, and to Lou Gomberg. I don't know if you know who he was. He's probably dead now that Fredrickson's taken over. They do all these statistics and what. And so all my young life, I wanted to do that. And then I came back, I lived in Europe for a while, and came back, I think it was 72 or early 73, and I thought, I don't have a job, and what am I going to do? And then I decided in the car coming, we were coming back from the Sierras, I'm going to restart my great-grandfather's winery. That's what I'm going to do, what I've always wanted to do. And I had no real wine knowledge, and I had no money. But I think if you really want something badly enough, if you're passionate about it, and you're willing to sacrifice and overcome obstacles, and there were a lot of obstacles, you can do it. You know, most anything. You know, I know I can't fly, but you can do a lot of things if you just make up your mind you're going to do it, and pay the price to get where you want to go. I went through a divorce. Over it, you know, my wife kept telling us she was from Finland. That's why I was in Finland for a while. And she kept, you're going to fail, you're going to fail. You hear that long enough, often enough, and you think, well, maybe I am going to fail. But anyway, it was really tough in the beginning. But all she wanted me to do was get a steady job, be a teacher or something. And I didn't want that. I wanted more than that. In any case, I believe passion should guide one. If you do something just because you want to make money, you're a prostitute. And you know, whether you're a baker or whatever, you're a prostitute. But if you do it for passion, because you really believe in it, you really want to do it, I think probably you'll make more money because you put your heart and soul into it, and you'll probably do a better job. But in any case, for me, it's always made me feel good if I can contribute something, again, make people happy, make them want to come back and tell their friends, and also make a profit.
Yeah.
And I feel real satisfied doing that.
Are you as passionate about it today as you were when you started?
No. I'm still passionate about it, but I'm being honest. When I first started, I'd read everything I could read. I was in tasting groups. I asked questions to everybody. I was crazy passionate. Now I'm just passionate, but I think I'm more subdued now. But at one point I just, and I was really worried too. Could I survive with Visa Tui Winery that I restarted in 75?
It wasn't the Napa Valley we know today back then at all.
Yeah, it's really changed a lot. In some ways for the better, but I think I liked it more then. Maybe because I'm older, I don't know.
Let me ask you this. If you were to give yourself a piece of advice from this vantage point from today and looking at yourself as a young man starting this, what would you say?
Probably I ended up with a master's from Cal. Probably I should have, after high school, gone in the wine business. I didn't need college, you know. Probably I, more well-rounded, speak better English. I could have gotten into the wine business and done even more and started earlier. I probably, Chuck Wagner from Camus, he didn't go to college.
Yeah.
He's a smart son of a gun. And he's selling a lot of great wines, doing really well. I'm really happy. We're good friends. I'm really happy for him. But some people maybe need college. It's an added plus, but I probably shouldn't have gone to college.
You know, I've heard that opinion a lot, is that college is just that. It's collegial, it's academic. It really doesn't give you life skills. It just gives you a lot of theory.
Not at all.
So that makes a ton of sense. So you went to Berkeley, right?
Went to San Jose State,
majored
in accounting and finance.
Okay.
And then I went to Berkeley and got an MBA in marketing.
Wow, so you went to school for quite a while.
Yeah. And then I also studied in Sweden. But I went to Sweden because I thought Swedish girls are the most beautiful in the world, so I moved there.
So I
went to university, but that wasn't really my focus.
Yes. So would it be fair to say that this is the only profession you would attempt? Or is there something else that you could have become had you not gone in the wine business?
I was in a lot of business. I think business is in my blood. And from 9, 10 years old, I always had a business going, always. San Jose State, Balfour, I don't know if you're in a sorority or not, but they'd come around, they'd sell you sweatshirts and rings and so forth. And they'd say 2 to 3 months delivery. And I thought, but I'm excited now. I just joined a fraternity. I want my shirt now. And it's 2 to 3 months delivery. I went down to a sporting goods store a week later, made arrangements with them. And then I could get 7 to 10 day delivery on this shirt. I took all his business, not his ring business, not his mug business, but all his shirt business. And then I went to Berkeley, to Stanford, to UOP, to University of Nevada, and started doing mail order. So I was making money, I was having fun. And then at Cal, I started this import business, Swedish clogs, wooden bottoms, and we were selling all over the United States. Filings of Boston, Macy's of New York, you name it, Lord & Taylor's, all over the United States. The problem was I didn't know anything about the shoe business or leather. I got cheated, I made mistakes, and I was too altruistic. I wanted to give good value. And the problem is everything in the world is going to go wrong at some point. And so I was trying to make it just a small markup, which was a stupid mistake. Anyway, so I learned from all these things. But
yeah.
So I was always in some kind of business. And I had a salesman in Boston, a salesman in San Francisco, and they canvassed all over. Anyway, so that's me. That's the way I approach things.
Where did this drive come from?
I don't know. I think it's innate. I think you're born with it. And my mother, she encouraged me. At 10 years old, no, it could have been 12, 10, 12. My mother would let me go from Fairfax, we lived in the poor town of Marin, to San Francisco, take the bus by myself, 24 miles away, and I go buy firecrackers. I buy, they come in 80 packs, and you know, I buy a lot of 80 packs, and then I buy them for 3.5 cents a pack, and I sell them Marin for 10 cents a pack. And so I was always doing something. I don't know, I don't know any other way. I can't fix a car, you know, I'm terrible at a lot of things, and I know that, but business, I'm okay. I enjoy it, and especially the wine business. Yeah, that's the only business I probably ever would have done.
Maybe just a sigh of relief. We're so glad. And I speak on behalf of a lot of consumers, and we'll get to it shortly, but I still want to explore a little bit of your upbringing. So what were your parents like?
And okay. My dad was only a high school graduate. He had a really tough life. His dad died at 29. The family accused the wife of murdering him because he was a playboy, a great-looking guy, and he had a lot of women. She didn't murder him, but they suspected that. So they took it out on my father, they took it out on his mother, my grandmother. Mm-hmm. So he had a tough life, and he became a cab driver, but he read philosophy. He wasn't happy with this world. I think he just got verbally abused and taken away from his mother by the courts, and went to Centerville Military Academy, and I don't know, it was really hard for him. But my mother, on the other hand, she was from Buffalo, Wyoming, of all places, and she was a rancher's daughter, and my grandfather on her side, her dad, ran away from home at 12 and ended up with the third biggest ranch in Wyoming, 144,000 acres, and wow. One of Wyoming's first millionaires, but he was, I guess, a really good business guy. I only met him once. And then she went through high school in 3 years, college in 3 years. Mm-hmm. So she was, my dad was kind of negative. It's always no, whatever I wanted to do is no, pretty much. And my mom was, yeah, go do it. And so I think I take after my mom, what I am, I think, really from my mom. And
so she your biggest
not influence. That my dad was a bad guy.
Right.
But he wasn't. But he just had a tough life, and it was kind of negative about stuff. Where my mom just go, and my mom was deaf. Had she not been deaf, she could have conquered the world. I mean, she was bright. She was, I remember in an airport, these deaf people, a couple times to come up to her with cards. I'm deaf. Give me some money.
Yeah.
Oh, would she read them out? You know, I'm deaf too, but I work for a living. And you know, boy, she'd, I'd cringe when she'd just lay into them. And she didn't pull any punches. But anyway, my mother was my real inspiration.
Wow, what a fantastic example of human being to grow up.
Allison, do me a favor, get a glass out of the cupboard and put some water in it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Wow. So at what point did you decide to continue your family? I know you're fourth generation Italian,
yeah.
Right? So
yes.
There was this winery in St. Helena that got, as you explain, artificially stopped by the prohibition. So the building was still there?
No.
No?
Let me correct you a little bit.
Okay.
They started in North Beach. He came in 1882.
Okay.
And he was the village baker in Italy, in a little mountain town outside Genoa.
Okay.
And so he worked 3 years as a baker, and his wife, Caterina, washed clothes for single miners, and then they started in a cellar making wine on the side, and she cooking and serving meals. There were a lot of single men still in San Francisco then. And then 3 years later, he started the winery, and so as a kid, my parents would often visit the typical Italian. My relatives lived upstairs from the old winery, which was in San Francisco.
Oh,
first in North Beach, but when I was born, No, let's see. Well, about around 1900, they moved to North Beach when the landlord, North Beach, they moved to the Mission District when the landlord raised the rent in North Beach and they built a building. So they had a full cellar and three stories above. In typical Italian, they lived up above the winery.
Sure.
And then when they were forced out of business, prohibition was repealed. They leased it to another winery called Montebello, not to be confused with the one on the peninsula, which went out of business around 1965 and continued to live upstairs. So my first impressions as a kid, that my aunt would open the door and it would reek of wine, and then I'd play among the barrels and the casks down in the cellar, and they'd show me some of the photos and tell me some of the stories. So I was immersed in that a lot, and so I was determined I was going to restart it and bring back the family winery.
So I know in Europe they let children taste wines, which of course is not the same in the U.S. unless a specific family makes those kinds of choices. So did you taste wine as a child growing up?
A little bit. I don't think I liked it too much as a young child. But I'm sure I tasted it at family picnic. They had a lot of al fresco out in the open picnics, basically Italian relatives. My Buffalo, Wyoming mother was, the one Midwesterner among all the Italians.
So when you decided to go after the wine business, tell me the very beginning, what happened, first of all in your mind, and then how did you execute?
Okay. When I decided to do it, I lived in a real cheap apartment in Napa and had almost no furniture. I was just trying to survive. I was working for BV at one point as a tour guide, $4 an hour. I worked for Christian Brothers as a cellar person. I taught school because I had a master's. They let me teach school, high school, grammar school. As a substitute, part-time. And basically, I was working on my business plan. So I was a disciplinarian. That's why they'd hire me, because I could keep I didn't have anything. So if the kids got out of line and they wouldn't keep quiet, I'd rough them up a little bit. So go ahead, sue me. I don't care. I don't have anything anyway. So in any case, I think that's why they'd hire me often, because I keep the class quiet. And then I work on my business plan. I shouldn't confess this, but I work on my business plan. Or I go to the doctor's office. I spread out all these papers, because doctors are always a half hour, 45 minutes late, right? So I spread all these papers. So I was constantly working on this and refining this business plan, which we've kept at Sertilli. It's almost not changed in 43 years. It almost hasn't changed. And I never thought we'd be so successful like we were, but I didn't plan for that. So I formulated this business plan. I didn't go to my relatives. I was too proud to do it, and they had the money. They could have helped me. What I did, I went everywhere else. I stuffed the United Airlines pilots' boxes with a brochure. Joe Long, that had Long's Drug Stores, he had over 300 of them. I got introduced to him when I was going to Cal. He went to Cal. I went in full of vigor and passion. I had this clog business, and I had all these orders. I couldn't finance the orders. And I walked out of there. Remember, this is 50 years ago, was $70,000, which is like $400,000 now. Indeed. After 45 minutes with Joe Long, I had to pay him back, which I did. But and so I thought he could finance the winery I wanted to start. But then the law said that if you have an on-sale license, I don't know if the same law now, because he sold wine in his stores, drug stores, you cannot own part of a winery. And I didn't know that for a while. And he would have financed the winery. So then the United Airlines pilots, everywhere I could go. And there were some people that believed in me because, I'd done pretty well at San Jose State and at Cal. But the people I knew didn't have any money either, because they were starting out in life. And I was so stupid. I didn't know that Davis had done a study saying that if you want to start a small winery, you need $1 million. I hadn't seen that study. So I was only trying to raise $100,000. And I still had a little money left over from money I'd made in Europe. I taught skiing. I didn't know how to ski, but I taught it anyway. I had a taxi service. I had a VW van, and I had a bed built back there because I traveled around. So I'd stop for hitchhikers, and I'd say, here's where I'm going. It's so much a kilometer. Do you want to come? I knew a lot of them were middle-class Americans, tired of waiting out in the sun. And so I ran a taxi service and going where I wanted to go. And a bunch of other things. I smuggled cigarettes and stuff into Sweden from East Germany. But anyway, I mean, small scale, right? It wasn't like a truckload, you know, around stocking around my belt, you know, around
it's
my
too
waist.
Bad there was no YouTube then. In any event,
so I hadn't seen the Davis study, and I had a little bit of money, but you know, one of my best friends, he gave me a note. Now, you know, I didn't need a note, I needed cash. So what I did, I think sometimes if you try hard enough, long enough, and you don't give up, you can get where you want to go. What happened, I was trying for 2 years and couldn't raise the money. And this guy that had been watching me, a realtor in Napa named Gene Kefoid, he's now dead, initially he said no, he wasn't going to be involved. But maybe he finally believed I could do it or something. And he bought the property where Satui was. I didn't have the money to buy the property. And he used his bank statement to put up the building. But I also got an option to buy the property back. And he got an option for cash or stock. Of course, he took the stock after a few years and then cashed it in at a formula. But in any event, so I never raised $100,000. I raised $62,500. That was all I could get. And then my brother-in-law put on the roof, and he got a percentage for that. A guy named Dick Gelati, Gelati Construction, you've seen his trucks around. Mm-hmm. He put in the foundation, the cement pad, and 20 parking spaces. He got 10% for that. He made a lot of money. And a few other people. And then, here's a great story. At BV, in the middle of my tour, I'd just take a minute or so, and I'd say something like, if you might be interested in investing in a small family winery, I want to restart my family winery, please see me after the tour. I eventually got fired for this because a boss saw it. And you know, I wasn't screwing up the tour. It just took a minute. Anyway, and almost nobody ever talked to me. But occasionally somebody would, a movie producer out of Hollywood, a brain surgeon out of Rochester, New York, and a couple other people, but in the end, nothing happened. And you know, I was getting desperate, I didn't know what to do. And then finally this guy, he looked older than he was about 5'6". He came up to me after a tour and he said, you know, I might be interested. So I took him up to the property where Satui is, scared to death because I had no right to be on the property. I knew it was for sale, but I thought if the housewife is at home, she's going to kick me off the property. So I had kind of one eye on the house, and I had everything in my head, where we were going to put the winery, everything we were going to do. And I related all this to him. And then I went to, he was a professor at UCLA. So I went down to Westwood a couple of times. I can't remember if he came back up. And then there were letters and phone calls. He became the second biggest investor, part of my 62.5, 15,000. And then, of course, there's a story on him. I didn't know who the guy was. He was so modest. One day after 5-6 years that Satui was open, the president of all 9 campuses of the University of California, now there's 10, came in and said, well, you know who Julian Swinger is, don't you? I said, yeah, professor at UCLA, and he's written a couple books. He must be pretty good. He said, you don't know who he is, do you? Come outside with me. And I was so entranced, I left some customers, and I went outside. I got to tell this story. At 15 years old, Julian Swinger was self-taught in physics. He'd go to the library and give lectures, and professors from some of the nearby universities would come, physics professors come to listen to his lectures. And one day, a physics professor at the library was walking by, and he thought Julian was faking it there to meet girls and do, you know, fake. And he's reading a book on Einstein, and the professor says, "Oh, tell me what this is all about." And so Julian told him, and he said, "But here, Einstein was wrong." And the professor thought, "You know, Julian's full of it." So he went back to his office and he did some research. The kid's right. Einstein was wrong there. Anyway, he was called one of the four great physicists. Three are Jewish. There was Feynman. I'm a Japanese guy. 21 years old. He went to Cornell. But he didn't go to classes other than physics classes. And he was flunking a bunch of classes, so they didn't know whether to kick him out of school or to give him a statue on campus because he was a physics genius. And finally, after a lot of debate, they decided to give him his PhD. He got a PhD at 21. Harvard made him a full professor at 21 years old. Nobody gets, you know, you're a TA, you're assistant professor, and maybe if you're good enough 10, 15 years down the road. Anyway, and then UCLA got him by giving him the university chair, which meant he was a top professor of all 9 campuses, that honor, and that's how they got him. And then one day he wandered up and invested. So I knew one of the great men in history, and he was so modest, he didn't tell him. He was invited to, he won the Nobel Prize and on and on and on. He invented radar, helped win the Battle of Britain because the Germans couldn't figure out how the British had all their planes always in the air when the Germans were coming because the British had radar first because of Julian. In any event, so great guy. And we got along well. I'd tell him where I saw it screwed up and where we did well. And then Situi did well. So, and now it's all in a trust for a physics foundation run by his colleague Putterman.
Wow, phenomenal speaking.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I digress.
No, but actually, this is wonderful because, well, you know, how many times do you come across such significant individuals and have them be in your corner? Yeah. That must have made you feel special, but also a bit of pressure. You had to perform because you borrowed this money and now you had to start a business.
Yeah.
And, you know, you didn't have any formal education when he came. You didn't go to UC Davis.
No, how did it all begin? I'm sorry?
How did it all begin? So you they're okay, rebuilding
now. So I got Gene Caffoy, the realtor, to buy the property, put up the building. I got an option to buy it back. But I still had no money. So the back was a winery. But I couldn't even afford the winery equipment. So I went to Complete Winemaker, a winemaking store for home winemaker, St. Helena, and I rented equipment. And then I got Diamond Creek Vineyards to put barrels. They thought I wanted to rent, which I did, but I wanted to fill up the back to the winery because I could only afford 25 barrels. And then I decided on the deli. That was part of my business plan. I bought an old deli case from a supermarket where Dean and DeLuca is now, is rusting outside. I paid $200 for that. And then I faced it with redwood so nobody could see the rust. And that was my deli case. And then I bought one picnic table. It's $93 from Sears Roebuck, remember, because I couldn't afford any more. And then I had some old barrels. I put planks over them for shelves. And I couldn't even afford a cash register, so I had a little wooden box. We wrote up every sale by hand. When I say we, it was me and my wife. And then made change out of the box. And then for a while, I slept on the winery floor. I did everything I could to try to survive that and make it work. And the first year, I was afraid if we lost money, I was gone. I'd have to go back work for somebody else. But we made $2,640. I still remember that. But I didn't have a forklift. I didn't have anything. I made all my calls collect. I had a hand crank calculator that I bought for $15, and I had two barrels with a reject door for my desk, and you know, whatever I could do to try to survive. And so far, so good.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.